Good afternoon and welcome to Boston Private's Best Practices for Business webinar, Tax and Business Planning to Maximize Your Benefits from Pass-Through Tax Cuts. We appreciate you tuning in and participating in our business focus update that takes into consideration tax reform. We conducted a workshop on February that focused on recent tax reform, and the feedback was outstandingly positive, so we received that resulted in this webinar, and we hope that you find this information very informative and helpful. So given the complex topic, we've budgeted about an hour. And if you're not able to stay for the full time, a replay will be sent to all registrants following the webinar. Our goal will be to discuss the new tax bill and how it will impact individuals or businesses for 2018 and beyond. And once again, we've assembled a terrific panel of experts that will boil down the details into helpful takeaways. I'm Brian Lopez. I'm a Managing Director of Retirement Plan Advisory Services for Boston Private. And for over 20 years now, I've worked with clients and companies and nonprofits to help them achieve their unique financial goals and objectives by assisting them in developing custom solutions for retirement savings and benefits programs. With us today, for those who listened to our last webinar, we're fortunate to have joining us Amy Sheridan of Sullivan & Worcester. Amy is a tax partner in the Boston office and concentrates her practice on business tax planning, employee benefits, and executive compensation. And thank you again, Amy, for taking the time away from your clients during this busy period to provide your insights. And of course, our moderator today is Washington Strategies and Planning expert, Doug Fisher. Doug works with companies to help protect, advise, and grow their businesses with Washington strategies and advocacy in the benefits area. Doug is the author of many of our thought leadership pieces that are contained in our email updates. And they're very extremely popular. Before his starting his consulting practice, Doug led Fidelity's legislative policy and thought leadership development teams involving retirement, health, and welfare benefit plans. And Doug will lead today's roundtable and offer insights into the latest discussions from Washington on the new tax law. And if time permits, we'll take questions. We want to hear from you, so please submit your questions to the webinar by typing them in the question box in the GoToWebinar control panel shown on the screen. We'll answer as many of these questions at the end of the webinar as possible. If we don't get to your questions, we'll follow up with an email. And as a reminder, we provide updates and industry trends in our thinking section of the website. Please continue to visit that website for any updates on upcoming client-related events, market news updates, and industry trends. We also have a section called the Washington Series that houses all the articles on this tax reform topic. So now, without further ado, I'll turn it over to Doug Fisher. Doug?
Great. Thank you, Brian. And it's great to be back with Amy and you for our second webinar on the new tax law. The new tax rate on pass-through entities will provide substantial tax savings for many, if not most, small businesses across the United States. In fact, 90% of businesses in our country are considered pass-through entities. Those are entities that are organized and operate their businesses as S-corporations, partnerships, limited liability companies, or LLCs, as you may know them, and sole proprietorship. Unfortunately, the pass-through tax rate is one of the most complicated sections of the new tax law. In order to implement this tax, which was a major campaign initiative of Republicans in the 2015 election, Congress had to create an entirely new section of the tax code to define which businesses qualify and how much tax benefit they receive. So why all the complication? Well, is it because Congress is out of touch with reality? You know, they define Washington as 12 square miles surrounded by reality, but that's only part of it. It's primarily because when you think about creating a separate tax rate for small business income that passes through to business owners' individual 1040s, what is happening then is, and the concern with policymakers, is with a lower tax rate on business income, it would further motivate business owners to reclassify higher tax wages, which are subject to FICA and FUTA, or in other words, Social Security taxes, away from wages and into lower tax business income. That was an overriding concern. The second policy issue that was part of the design, and we'll spend a fair amount of time talking with Amy about this because she has some tremendous insights about how to maximize the pass-through if you do qualify, is the idea that Congress felt that economic growth was boosted by providing a special tax rate for businesses that actually derive most of their revenue from investing in property, plant, and equipment and hiring non-owner employees. And you'll see this through the entire design of the deduction-based system that this new provision creates. As I said earlier, the new law clearly creates winners and losers, and you want to be on the winner side. And Amy will provide ideas and insights to help you plan for this. Careful planning, and we can't emphasize this enough, careful planning with your tax advisor is key to maximizing the benefits of the new law and sort of sorting through, as we call it, the jungle that sort of exists in navigating this new tax provision. But before I turn it over to Amy for an overview, let me lay out the framework for today's discussion so it's easier to follow. So first, we'll start with an overview of the individual and corporate tax rates. There was a substantial tax rate reduction for C corporations as well. Second, we'll discuss what type of businesses qualify for the special tax-through rate. We call those good businesses, for lack of, you know, just to keep clear what is good and what is bad, facilitates our discussion. Third, we'll talk about how the pass-through deduction is calculated. It's a pretty complicated formula. Fourth, we'll talk about how to maximize the deduction to lower your taxes. And fifth, we'll compare the new C corporate tax rates with pass-throughs. There's some interest in pass-through entities thinking about taking advantage of the lower corporate tax rate, but we know it's a complicated consideration and process, and Amy has a lot of insight for us. So now, Amy, let me turn this over to you for an overview.
Thanks, Doug. I thought it might be useful just to level set a little bit so that we're all on the same page about the basics of how U.S. business taxes work. Essentially, for U.S. tax purposes, the world is divided into two groups. You're either in a pass-through business form that includes sole proprietorships, partners, most LLCs, or S corporations, or you are in an entity level form, which is a C corporation. Pass-throughs are taxed as if the individual earned the income directly, so it's taxed at all business income is taxed at individual rates. The highest marginal tax rate is 37%. If you are able to qualify for this new qualified business income deduction, if you're a good business and meet all the limitations that we'll discuss, the highest marginal tax rate is effectively lowered from 37% to 29.6%. C corporations, in contrast, are taxed twice. Income is taxed at the C corporation level. This is taxed at the much ballyhooed new C corp rate of low 21%. But if the income comes out and is distributed to the owner as a form of a dividend, it's also taxed again. At the highest rate, it's 20%. What does this mean? It means that when you add the C corp rate and the dividend rate, the business income is effectively taxed at 36.8%. Notice that's very close to 37%, which is the highest marginal tax rate on individuals. Stated differently, if you have to take the money out of a C corp, there's no advantage to being in a C corp versus being in a pass-through, at least from a pure income tax perspective. On top of that, one thing that we will mention and discuss later is there are risks associated with being in a C corp form if you try to use the business as a piggy bank to accumulate income. These are the accumulated earnings and personal holding company taxes. They are an additional 20%. So if those taxes come into play, it's clearly not better to be in a C-Corp form.
Amy, let me ask you a question. So you mentioned earlier that, and I'm focusing on the pass-through component. So the highest marginal tax rate under the new law is 37%.
Right.
And that starts at taxable income of $600,000 for those that file joint returns, and what is $500,000 for single.
Yeah.
But so what's interesting is about that is your tax rate, if you're in the highest tax rate of 37%, a 20% deduction as you work through the pass-through pushes your rate to 29.6. But if you're in a lower individual tax rate, the 20% reduction may push you into a lower rate.
Even lower.
So it's tax bracket based.
It is tax bracket based. So 29.6 is a highly simplified number. It is not, it's ignoring the marginality of rates and the fact that the deduction could actually move you to a lower bracket.
Yes. And the highest rate, though, under pass-through, it would be if you're in the top rate, is 29.6. And that hence is the appropriate comparison. Now, Brian, let me bring you into the conversation.
Sure.
With the bank. You know, those of us that are like Amy are tax experts and working with this with her clients every day, and I'm in Washington around a lot of policymakers and think tanks that are thinking through this, the application of the pass-through. What are you seeing in terms of your clients with the Boston Private Bank in relation to this, the importance of this pass-through rate?
Oh, it's absolutely important. It's coming up in every conversation, and it's certainly something that, you know, I think as new information comes due and comes through, and as new as the data gets dissected, you know, in terms of the good versus bad businesses and those what if scenarios develop, I think ultimately, to your point, about 90% of our businesses are pass through businesses, maybe a little bit higher than that. So it definitely applies to those businesses, and those conversations are taking place every day with different, whether they're wealth or bankers or commercial lenders here at Boston Private.
Right. So a very topical conversation with clients. So now let's dive into the core of the complexity of the rule. And let's explore the question of, does your business qualify for the pass-through tax rate? As I noted earlier, Congress clearly drafted this provision to pick winners and losers. And what we're trying to do today is point out how to be on the winning side of this provision. And that means qualifying for the pass-through tax rate. So let me frame the discussion as follows. Basically, you should start with the premise that your business qualifies as long as it's not in one of the forbidden three categories of businesses or industries. First, personal service businesses do not qualify for the pass-through rate. And I'll talk about, if you're in this, do not despair. There is an exception, a narrow exception that we'll spend some time with. And the second category, which is the, well, let me, before I go, let me just go through what the service businesses are. Those are businesses you see on the bottom of the slide. Those include law, accounting, actuarial science, arts, consulting. Athletics is an interesting one. That's the Steph Curry provision. The actual, when the Republicans were drafting this blueprint, they actually mentioned that Steph Curry would not qualify for the special pass-through rate. And the president mentioned this, and when he was asked about it after one game, he was perplexed why he would even be the subject of this. And so,
yeah, I do think this is the first time we've had guidance via tweet.
Yeah, tweet. That was it. It was very odd, odd politics coming out of Washington. Financial services, brokerage services, healthcare. These are the traditional personal service businesses that Congress said should not qualify for the pass-through. And they said that because Congress views these businesses as deriving most of their income from the labor of owners, and that should be appropriately categorized as wages and not business income. And they made a a political judgment that that shouldn't be subject to the special pass-through rate. Now, there's a second category in the forbidden three. And the second category is sort of the catch-all. If you don't fit into one of these personal service business categories, this is the kind of business where the primary asset is the skill or reputation of owners and employees. And this, for this, a classic example is a consulting business, for example, and it's the broad catch-all. And the third category, Amy mentioned a moment ago, and that's C corporations. C corporations, if you're organized and operate, you get the special flat 21% rate and don't need this. Yeah. So basically, if you fit into one of the forbidden three, there are exceptions. These are these exceptions that are negotiated in the late hours of the structure of this bill. And the exceptions are, some of them are very interesting. First of all, there's an exception for small personal service businesses. So personal service businesses are defined as businesses where the owners have taxable income. This is the taxable income that's measured at the 1040 before tax credit, where the taxable income is less than $315,000 for joint filers and half that for individual filers. There was a heated negotiation during the late hours on this bill where Ron, I call this the Ron Johnson provision from Wisconsin. Ron Johnson is a former small business owner, a Republican from Wisconsin, and basically said to the Republican leadership, I'm not voting for this bill. And for the life of me, I do not understand why income that's derived by personal services doesn't get the same tax rate as income that's earned by other businesses that qualify. And so through that negotiation, they carved out the smaller personal service businesses that qualify. And that phase out of the deduction is completely phased out at taxable income of $415,000. So if you're between $315,000 and $415,000, part of your business may qualify for the special pass-through tax rate. The second exception for businesses that qualify is architecture firms and engineering. This is a curious exception. Again, negotiated in the wee hours of this bill. And I was told when I met with the tax staff that drafted this provision is that it was included because of the need for architecture and engineering in relation to the real estate industry. Although I expect that architecture and engineering related to other kinds of industries will likely qualify. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to see there. But those are the three exceptions as well. Now, let's dig a little bit deeper into the service business definition. And this is where I want to bring Amy into the conversation, because there's more than meets the eye here. There's a lot of research going on into what is a principal asset of a trade of business. And what does it mean that you derive your income from the reputation or skill of one or more employees? And then there's also, we'll have a discussion concerning consulting, because consulting is a very broad category and maybe actually narrower than we first thought. And there may be some flexibility if you're in one of those businesses to potentially qualify. So, Amy, let's go through a number of questions that business owners are asking in relation to these definitions of non-qualifying or bad businesses, because there's more flexibility potentially to qualify your business than meets the eye.
Yeah, I agree, Doug. At least until we get guidance, I think when you're a tax lawyer, you read words like consulting, you start asking yourself, what does consulting mean? It's obvious to everyone else, but not when you're a tax lawyer and you live in a very definitional world. So just to go through some of the questions that we are dealing with, what does a principal asset of a skill or business If I were to ask most of my clients, they would say, of course, they're, as the owner, their principal asset of the business is their own skill. We think we're hopeful that we're going to get a very broad, a very narrow definition of what this means. We have two private letter rulings that are out there involving the biotech industry, where the service interpreted this definition to not include businesses that were frankly primarily IP businesses. So we're hopeful that this is going to be a narrow definition.
Okay, so because when I think about the skill of owner employees, I've sort of felt being in the consulting side, I'm a very small consulting business, so it is my skill. But at some point, a consulting business, doesn't it become just bigger than the individual at some size? So you're actually producing income from other assets. Is that a potential? I mean, I'm thinking of like a national consulting firm. It's more than just the name of Deloitte now. It's really the
I think where people get very concerned is when, you know, particularly in the Boston area, when we've got, you know, very smart people who have really added a lot of value to a startup, a biotech, those kind of industries. The fact that it's really their knowledge that has made the business viable. Where is that line? And I, from these rulings, we're optimistic that if you're doing something other than just relying on your own brain, that hopefully that should be enough to get you out of this definition. So, we had a client who, smart MIT PhD, who wanted to start a biotech firm. We're fairly optimistic that that client won't, even despite the fact that the truth is that it's his brain that has generated all this income. What we're hopeful is that given the way the service has traditionally interpreted this definition, because the business actually does something other than his own personal services, that should be sufficient.
Yeah, and I could see a common example, Amy, where you start out with an idea as a consultant, the idea leads to software or it leads to building a patent on a process, and then the process becomes really the product of the organization.
Right.
So it sounds like
we're hopeful
there's some flexibility. So let's go on to this question. Boston Private Bank has a number of clients in the real estate business. And one of the areas we talked about in planning for this, and this goes to what is a trade or business? Does it have to, there are different kinds. There are passive businesses and there are active businesses. So obviously we want as many businesses to qualify as possible. So we're starting to dissect that definition. So what's going on? What are your thoughts on this triple net lease issue? This is something that keeps coming up.
Yeah. So let me first say in the statute of 199A, the qualified business income deduction, there's nothing that distinguishes between passive and active businesses. It seems that whether or not you're active in the business is not relevant to whether or not you get to take advantage of this deduction. We'll have to see how regulations develop on this, but for now, that's what it seems. On this question, we have the IRS has taken a stand in the preamble to the net investment income tax regs, a different set of regulations, that if all you did was triple net lease a single business, that wouldn't a single property, that alone wouldn't be enough activity to give rise to a quote-unquote trader business. The question is exactly where is the service going to draw the line, or are they going to use these regulations that we get under 199A as a way to get more guidance on that? The case law is more favorable than where the service has ended up, so this could be an area of litigation.
Yeah, because I've got to believe that a lot of people in the business start up with one property, maybe have two or three now, and when did that cross the
right.
line? And
right.
so that's an area that is worth exploring with your advisor.
Absolutely.
Because it may afford you the access to the special tax deduction. Now, in a related real estate question again, Amy, that seems to be coming up is investment management. Which is a bad business, one of those listed professional service businesses. Does real estate fit into that and disqualify?
So not based on where they placed the comma in the statute.
Yeah, okay. Now we get to a true lawyer. Value and worth is where the comma is. Okay.
So I'll just say, we do not. We believe that management of real estate should be a good business as shorthand for a qualifying business for purposes of the regulation. Management of securities, however, is out.
Yes, even though we were talking before the webinar today, and you could make the argument now that many brokerage firms or even banks are more technology companies now, with trading software and so on, than they are personal service.
Yes. Doug, I think just to reiterate a point you made earlier, these good and bad businesses, and my personal, these are my editorial comments, are completely random. I mean, 90% of the industry of the United States is in some sort of service business, and trying to draw these lines, and we can talk about consulting as an example of how do you draw the line between what is a service business and what is not a service business in this economy, is very complicated, and there are no clear lines. So again, you should consult with your tax advisor. Consulting point, is that where the next question is?
I'm just upset because it feels like I don't qualify.
Well, join the club.
Yeah.
The consulting business, we are hopeful that what we may get a narrow definition of consulting based on a footnote in the conference report, which seems to define consulting as the mere giving of advice, not the implementation of advice. So you can imagine a lot of businesses, a real estate developer who is out there looking for real estate to purchase, is that if you are advising on what real estate to purchase, does that make you a consultant? Well, we believe no. We believe that if you're actually implementing the decisions based on the advice you're giving yourself, that should mean that you are not a mere consultant. Sorry, Doug.
Yeah, no. Okay, there you go. So I have to execute on my own advice?
There you go.
And then the last question really goes to something we talked about a minute ago on engineering and architecture. And even though this provision, according to the tax staff and the Senate, was added late in the negotiations related to real estate, and a certain person in the government that has a lot of real estate was also mentioned in the same breath. I believe this is going to be a subject of a lot of discussion where businesses that are part engineering and part architecture, because that can happen. Those kind of things can happen in any kind of business, mm-hmm. really, whether you're manufacturing the algorithms for software or you're doing architecture for more than, you could say software or hardware, all those kind of things. So it's a pretty broad definition that may swallow the rule. So I would expect we might see some regulations on that. But for the good news now is that I think it's helpful for qualifying. So now let's talk about the second important part of the pass-through deduction. We've talked about what are the issues in qualifying and becoming a good versus a non-qualifying for bad business. The actual tax deduction is based on the tax benefit is based on a deduction system which reduces the amount of business income, which has the effect, as Amy noted in our early on, which reduces your effective tax rate. So it was structured as a deduction. And the deduction is based on the amount of qualified business income that each of your businesses produces. This is an important point because it doesn't permit aggregation of different businesses. Each business must go through, if it is qualified first, to determine what is its qualified business income. Now, one of the areas that this raises, and we'll talk about this more in a moment, is what if you have good income and bad income in one business? It's going to be a very common thing, and Amy has some very interesting things to say about that. So the tax policy here, as we go through this complicated deduction, just keep in mind that the public policy from Washington here is to reward businesses, and you'll kind of see this as we go through the actual math, It's to reward businesses that derive most of their income from buying and investing in property, plant, and equipment. We sort of call that the asset test. And those that employ and hire employees that are non-owners. So you can see they're making a distinction from personal service businesses, and this formula clearly reinforces that. So let's walk through the deduction. The deduction, and again, this is how much, this is basically calculating your pass-through income then out of your total income that then is reduces the amount of income subject to tax. The deduction here is equal to the lesser of 20% of each of your pass-through entities' income that are qualified, or the greater of these two. So it's the lesser of 20% or the greater of two additional calculations. So think of the 50% of wage as the wage limit and the 25% of wage and the 2.5% of unadjusted basis, that's a mouthful, as the asset. And so what happens here is when you work through this formula, the formula clearly rewards businesses that are investing in hiring people that are non-owners, that's the wage, and those that are investing in wage and equipment.
Let me just, you can, the wages we believe for this purpose will include wages paid to owners.
Oh, it will.
In an S-corp, we believe so, yes.
In an S-corp?
Or
in a partnership?
Well, that's there's some question as to how to aggregate businesses for this purposes. If you have,
helpful.
Treasury takes the view that you cannot be a partner and employee of the same entity. So it won't be possible to just sort of pay yourself more wages if you're in a partnership, mm-hmm. if you're a partner in a partnership. But it's not uncommon to be an employee of a related entity, either a partner and a general partner, for example, in the partnership or a subsidiary of the partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the unknown questions is, will wages paid by those affiliated entities count towards the wage and property limitation that's used in calculating the QBI deduction with respect to income earned by the partnership itself?
Well, that's an important point because you can use higher wages for paid to owners to actually increase your qualified business income deduction.
Right, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and there's and what we're finding out is that, and Amy will go into this in more detail, there's the smart people that are looking through this rule, into this rule, are finding some rules of thumb on the relative relationship of how much wages you pay in relation to how much equipment you buy, sort of golden or rule of thumbs that will help you maximize the deduction. And just keep in mind how this deduction works, because it's very different than most tax rate reductions. It is, you calculate whether you determine if you're a qualifying business. Once you determine that, and we just talked about that, then you got to calculate the amount of qualified business income you have. And then from qualified business income, you figure out the amount that you can deduct. That deduction has the effect of reducing your tax rate on your 1040. So that's kind of where we are in this process. So Amy, let me ask you this question. And it goes to this concept of, and it's going to be very common, and you must be seeing this in your practice, is that you're having business owners come to you and saying, I might have some personal service business, and then I have some real estate business, for example, that qualifies. So I have some good and some bad businesses. And so you're spending a fair amount of time trying to sort through that.
Right. So let me give you an example. We have a client who came in a few months ago, the veterinarian business. Veterinarians, we believe their traditional work would be to provide medical services to animals. There's some guidance out there that suggests that. But vets also do all sorts of things, grooming. They sell, you know, dog products, things that may not be service businesses. And so what we are, and I will say that we're still considering these, or at least we're advising clients on the pros and cons of doing these things until we get formal guidance. One thing you can consider to do is to break out what I'll call your good business and your bad business. As I alluded to before, though, the wage and property limitation follows the business. So it's a business-by-business determination. So if you're going to break out your good business from your bad business, what that means is that any wages he pays for veterinarian assistance, for himself as the vet, the service provider, you won't necessarily get to count those towards the good business. So until we get guidance, this becomes very difficult, but we've got to be able to trace the wages with the good business and apply those against that towards that limitation and that QBI deduction, and then trace wages that are also paid with respect to the bad business and not use those wages. So it becomes a complicated analysis.
Is that a case by case?
It's case by case, and you do what you can to justify, the wages that are paid, maybe to the person at the front desk who rings out, who pays for the wages paid to the groomer, or the wages for the shopkeeper for the vet business that pays for all the dog, all the dog paraphernalia that I have collecting in my house. I feel like I spend a ton of money on that. Those wages should count towards the good business and should count to increase the wage and property limitation, so that you can maximize the QBI deduction with respect to that good business.
And that's the QBI, is the qualified business income, which creates the deduction. So, Amy, we spent some time on the importance of paying wages and locating wages into the good business. What if you're in a business that is capital intensive, mm-hmm. and very low wage paying? And I'm thinking of like a real estate management business. And can you take us through how the formula, the asset-based test, sort of saves that business and favors
it? Yeah, so there is a cutoff. I want to say it's about 8 times income. I haven't double-checked that. There is a point at which property alone will maximize your wage and property limitation. If you look back at the formula on the prior, I don't know if we can go back.
Yes.
Just to remind everybody, what you're trying to do is you need either 50% of the wages you paid in your qualifying business, or 25% of the wages plus 2.5% of the unadjusted basis of qualified property, to at least equal 20% of your qualified business income, because it's at that point that you'll be able to maximize your deduction. I'm going to talk in a little bit. If you go over that, it's bad. Because then you're paying too much in wages, or if you purchase too much property. The qualified business income definition is a net income-based test. So you've got two competing forces here. You need to maximize your wage and property limitation. But once you hit that equilibrium where it's equal to 20% of qualified business income, if you start spending too much on wages or buying too much property, you decrease your amount of qualifying business income, because that is a net income calculation. So there is an equilibrium point that we'll discuss.
Amy, one other point here. What about those businesses, and this goes to one of the points here, a qualified business income is reduced by capital gains dividends. So if you're in the business of investing money, those assets receive other special tax rates and are excluded. So you can't sort of, in essence, pump up your net business income, hence pump up your deduction by using those sources. Amy, one question about the asset test before we, and I want to explore a little more deeper in the golden rules here in a moment, is when you're thinking about those businesses that may rely on the asset purchase test, what kind of assets are included?
So it's all depreciable property. It's any property that you purchase during the year. So you can purchase property during the year to increase your wage and property limitation. My personal view is that if you're choosing between wages and property, it's somewhat of a complex analysis. I think wages are easier to turn, I don't mean to sound crude, we're an at-will employment. It's a little bit easier to turn off wages. One thing we worry about, this deduction goes away in 2026. If you increase wages to an owner, are you now resetting some of your reasonable comp limitations, which tax lawyers worry about, the IRS coming in and arguing that you've paid too much compensation to yourself or too little compensation to yourself, and wanting you to justify how much compensation is being paid. So once this goes away in 2026 and you've been increasing your wages to maximize this deduction, are you now stuck paying yourself all these wages once 2026 rolls around.
Yeah, and with wages come benefit costs.
And benefit costs and all of that.
Kind of things, so.
On the other hand, they're all deductible up front, whereas property is depreciable over time. So from a tax perspective, wages can be less expensive than property.
Okay.
Or so property also appreciates. So this is a complex analysis.
Yes. So, but the law gives you some control over this. Now, Amy, let's go. This is a very important section of the new law in terms of this thinking about how to maximize the formula in terms of wages and wages and asset, the two elements that may come to play to limit the 20%, because eventually you want to maximize your deduction by getting to that 20% reduction in your net business income, because the other two will limit you unless you sort of play those right and get those in the right formula here. So let's explore this a little bit deeper. When as you're working with clients, they're asking you this question: when does it make sense to pay more wages? Now, you raise the issue about sort of the idea of once you start increasing wages, does that create other costs? But what are you thinking there?
Yeah. So here's the key. Here's one thing to remember: if you are not maximizing your wage and property limitation, that is the wage and property limitation formula, yields an amount that is less than 20% of your qualified business income, you are going to get more bang for your buck by paying more wages and increasing the amount, your wage and property limitation, than the cost of those wages. So the wages you can think about, they're subject to self-employment or employment taxes. Those costs is actually less than the benefit of the deduction. Now, this is driving tax lawyers crazy. I mean, this is complete, flies in the face of everything we've tried to do forever, which is to reduce the amount of wages or the amount of income that's subject to employment taxes. That's the main rule of thumb. All of that has been flipped on its head. We are now finding ourselves advising clients, and I did just the other day, you should increase the amount of wages that you should consider whether to increase the amount of wages that you're paying yourself as the owner of the business in order to maximize this QBI deduction.
So that's an important point, because the place where you probably have the most flexibility in maximize, if you have to max wages, is paying owners of your
that's
business.
Right.
And that's probably the first place to start.
Right. Let me say one rule that has not been overturned, a rule of economics. It does not make sense to hire someone and pay somebody else as an owner of a business unless you think they can add more value to your business. That is still true. Okay, I want to be clear about that.
Yes.
One interesting thing, though, is you might want to look at whether you're properly characterizing your independent contractors. There is now an incentive to treat them as employees. I'll also just make a note. I don't know if I'm going ahead, but
no,
if
fine.
You're giving out profits interest and you're part as a partnership, profits interest will convert employees to partners. It means that you lose those wage payments, and those then become guaranteed payments to a partner, which will not count towards your wage and property limitation. So for those businesses that have been giving out profits interest like candy, you might want to reconsider that action.
So let's explore that for a moment, Amy, because it's an important point. So wages paid to shareholder owners can actually help boost up your wage limitation.
Right.
And in essence, reduce the negative effect of that.
Right.
Payments to partners, guaranteed payments to partners, which are normally like wages.
Those do not.
Do not.
Right.
And then if you happen to have a partnership law firm, so those are guaranteed payments. How about sole proprietor? Pay yourself more wages. It actually can help you.
Sole proprietor is a little tricky, but the easiest thing to think of is an S-corp owner.
Okay, S-corp owner. Okay. So those are pretty dicey rules, but important to think about when you do that calculation. So, Amy, you mentioned earlier, anything to add on the idea of allocating wages from a bad or non-qualifying business doesn't qualify for the special tax rate, to a good business? And I'm thinking these common paymaster ideas, or
yeah,
what do
so
you think?
One of the questions that's outstanding is, again, and this, I talked a little bit about this in the partnership context, where you're a partner of a partnership and then an employee of a related entity. The same issue comes up in the Common Paymaster scheme, which is commonly used. What we don't know yet without guidance is how are we going to allocate wages paid amongst, you know, a conglomerate or a, you know, multi-entity business? How do we group, you know, businesses together, and how do we allocate those wages? It's one of the unknowns.
And do you expect guidance on that? Because this,
yeah,
this could be a very common thing. Like in real estate management, you might have a group that just manages property, and you have other, each building may be in a separate entity.
Yeah, I have. So the International Association of Accountants, they have proposed that we jettison this entire trader business concept and just rely on the passive versus non-passive activity rules, which some of you on the phone may, or the webinar may be aware of. I think there's not a lot of support for that. The problem has been traditionally that the service has not wanted to give us, has been reluctant to give us explicit guidance on how to group businesses. We have court cases that discuss when, for example, a partner is engaged in the trader business of the partnership. We have Sun Capital, which was really about when the, really about a partnership being engaged in the general partner's trader business. We've got some controversial decisions, and we don't have a ton of clear guidance from Treasury on exactly how you group businesses. So we'll have to see what happens and whether Treasury decides to use this as the, as an opportunity to give us guidance on this, or whether we're going to get an entire, something entirely different and say, forget trader business, go with, you know, passive activity rules.
Yeah, short of that, that kind of major change, because the structure of the statute isn't design versus active or versus passive. It's really based on the kind of business you're in. You are actually diagramming new business structures now for your clients in various areas, trying to see what makes sense. Are you going to that far still?
Not until we get guidance. It's very hard.
You're holding off.
We're holding off
until you get guidance. And who knows with this administration whether they'll get guidance. Have you heard whether it's, I've heard that
you have heard,
late
heard
summer, and you know, you think about the filing season is what is it, 12, 15 months away, and the guidance process. I know they're working on it, but can they address all these issues? So
I see that's one of the questions that a lot of our callers are asking now is when is the guidance released?
Yeah, so I think there's a point at which if you don't have guidance, and it's likely guidance could come out just before, you know, in January, February, March, maybe March of next year. So there's a year to get that done. So it still makes sense to do as much planning ahead of time, assuming that it may not answer all these questions.
Yeah, I mean, what we are doing is sitting down with clients and explaining the risks. Some of these things have, are, some of these decisions are riskier than others. Some of them are harder to unwind than others. At some point, though, I think people will start pulling the trigger on things, even without guidance.
You know, one of the, Brian, let me turn to you. One of the other areas that one of the three exceptions to the personal service business exclusion is that if you're in a smaller personal service business that might be on the cusp of having maybe reporting income over between $400,000 and $500,000 of taxable income, they need to get their taxable income from their, you know, from measured on their 1040 down below 415. Are there things like retirement plans that they can use to create a big deduction to ensure they qualify?
Oh, absolutely. I think we saw that over the years. We've seen those cash balance type plans, which is the hybrid between the defined benefit and defined contribution plans, be reviewed through the actuarial calculations. And I know there's some, like you say, good businesses and bad businesses. There's some good demographics and some bad demographics for organizations to kind of think through and put those types of plans in place. So, you know, we are seeing and hearing from a lot of our third-party administrator partners that they're looking, a lot of organizations are looking at these calculations and considering putting these types of cash balance plans, which have some shelf life to them, in place as a complement to their 401k plans or their 403b plans.
Sure. Amy, you do a lot of benefit work as part of your tax practice. If you're a small business that's thinking about this, what are the Brian mentioned demographics. What are the demographics that make sense for like a cash balance, which is a hybrid plan that allows sort of large defined benefit type of deductions, but it comes with some cost.
Yeah, no. So the benefit, particularly with the QBI deduction, could be huge. I think they're most useful if you have an older owner population and relatively few younger employees. I think that's really the sweet spot that folks are looking for.
And I'm seeing that as a former recovering benefit lawyer turned lobbyist in Washington. I'm seeing a lot of interest in firms that specialize in combining a 401k for that specific type of business with that demographic, combining a 401k with a defined benefit plan, and they're literally able to create deductions of hundreds of thousands of dollars to otherwise qualify for a personal service business. And I've thought about it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So you might wonder why I know so much about this.
A lot of my partners are banging on
that. Yes, they are. Amy, one more question before I leave this topic. And this goes to Boston Private's clients in the real estate. In many cases, business owners that have regular businesses and then need real estate to put their business in, a typical structure would be to buy, the owner buys the business individually and then leases it to the business rather than having that asset in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason to change that given the asset? The point we talked about where having the asset in the business to maximize the asset test, is there any?
These are the same questions. The asset test also applies on a business by business basis. So at this point,
so if it sits outside and you lease it into the business, and
where is it being used in the business or not? I think this where is the business is the question.
Right, because the depreciation is out at the individual level, but the business is paying a lease payment.
Right. It's unknown, and we don't know how to draw these circles yet.
Okay. All right. So we talked about that, how to maximize businesses. Brian mentioned the option of cash balance plan, if it makes sense. Amy, let me turn to you then. I'd ask you to compare the C corporate tax rate, which is a flat 21%, which is one of the lowest probably in the world now.
It's about middle of the pack.
About middle of the OECD countries,
yep.
Versus the top pass-through rate. Are you having discussions with businesses, pass-through businesses that are thinking about taking all or part of their businesses and moving it into a C-Corp, especially maybe a bad business to take advantage of that rate? And what are the considerations?
Yeah, so this is one of the decisions that I would put in the category of once you're in, it's hard to get out. So this is one we're treating it very seriously. I do think you'll see some news reports about folks, they're moving to a C-Corp. The problem with moving to a C-Corp is that it's hard to get out of a C-Corp, particularly if you were formerly an S-Corp. There's a period of time you have to wait. It also, if you need to take the money out of the business, as I mentioned earlier, once you have to incur the dividends, it's not worth the 21% rate. You end up right where you started at, almost the 37% rate. So I think, you know, where we're looking at this seriously are folks who do not have an exit planning strategy. I will just mention a statistic that I heard. Almost 60% of family businesses do not make it to the second generation, meaning that they have engaged in a sale. If there's going to be a sale transaction, C-Corp form may not be the best form. On the other hand, a lot of venture capital firms like C-Corp form. And so it might be, you know, you probably actually already are in a C-Corp form if you're looking for VC money. So let me show you where we are looking at it. We're looking at it as sort of a blocker to a bad business. And If you look at the business on the left, I did the first part, I separated out a good business from a bad business. What some folks are considering where they can take money out of the good business and leave that as a pass-through, putting in a C-Corp blocker over the bad business and not taking money out of that business and reinvesting the business income back into the business. And that structure does seem to be having some legs, and we have been implementing that with various clients.
And so, Amy, can you give me an example of the kind of business, without naming names, of course, where you might be doing this blocking strategy, where it makes sense?
So I have to be careful, but I'll just say, and the veterinarian business I'm thinking of isn't doing this, but they could be. They could put their vet business with a C Corp on top if they had enough, if they were willing to reinvest the proceeds back into the vet business.
Because it's a bad business.
It's a bad business.
Personal service business under the law.
Right, and leave the grooming business in as a pass-through, you know, as a good qualifying business, and take the money out of the good business they need to, you know, eat and live on.
And the veterinarian example could equally apply with a medical practice. For example, if you had a medical practice where you're providing traditional medicine, but you also run a billing service or a physical therapy maybe service,
yep,
or even a consulting business.
Consulting business,
that,
yeah.
Where this formula might make some sense. So, Brian, let me turn to you. We have about 4 minutes or so left for questions.
Yeah, I mean, the one overarching question that has come through, we've got a number of questions here, is when are we expecting guidance? But the one that I thought might be helpful for folks is, are single member LLCs treated differently? No employees, no separate tax filing. Is that?
So single member LLCs you can think of as sole proprietorships. You know, there are no employees in a sole proprietorship, so you're gonna, if you are above the wage and property limitations, your property may be your best bet to try and increase that limitation. If there are no employees, other employees.
I'm an attorney with an S corporation. Does the new tax law benefit me? If so, how?
Are you a tax attorney? No.
If it does, then we'll get your kids through college.
If you're a tax attorney, you're set. Yeah. It depends on your income level. If you're earning over the taxable income threshold, then you are a specified service business, and no, you cannot take advantage of the new qualified business income deduction. If you're below the income threshold, then yes, you can take advantage of the QBI deduction.
There's one more that I'd like to ask. How is all this affected by having a consulting business with limited consulting income, but if you have a significant income,
yeah,
from sale or license of patents issued a number of years ago?
Okay, so this is one of the very interesting questions, is what's going to be the de minimis amount of bad, I'm going to say bad, again, this isn't my view, this is apparently Congress's view that there are good and bad businesses in the world, that what's the de minimis amount of bad business income that you can have without tainting the entire business? That's the CPA group that I was referring to earlier. They have suggested a 5% of gross revenue threshold. So as long as the consulting business wasn't generating more than 5% of the overall gross revenue of the business, under that test, it would be okay. At this point, we do not have guidance. And it's really a case-by-case judgment call. I'm hoping that we do get guidance on what it means to, you know, what a de minimis amount would be. Okay.
Yeah. And this sounds like kind of a example where some restructuring and separation of the good business with the bad business may make sense, especially
right,
if the patent revenue is
significant
right, as well.
But again, we need to allocate wages or property,
yeah,
to that income, which is one of the problems with the IP issue, is that typically there are not wages or property,
yeah,
depreciable property associated with that. So that's a hard,
yeah,
question. If I were in that taxpayer's shoes, I would be hoping that we get some sort of de minimis rule that's helpful.
Yeah, I as I think about all the open questions, this is one of them that it just feels like the Treasury has to put guidance out there here pretty quickly to give people a sense.
Sounds like it could be round three for the tax
yeah,
experts here. The last one is, can I have the contact for the presenter, a tax attorney? Yeah, I guess we can shoot that out, of
absolutely
course. Absolutely.
Amy is fabulous.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
She spends her almost her entire day, I assume, doing that.
I do. I do.
Yeah.
I do.
And the last one, I guess, would be NAIC codes. Could NAICS codes, do you expect that might be the breakdown between good and bad qualifying versus non-qualifying businesses? Could that be the possible solution?
Maybe it's something very formality driven. Maybe we'll have to see what happens. Maybe they'll punt. In my mind, that would be a complete punt. But but maybe.
All right. Well, Doug and Amy, thank you once again for taking the time to be with us here today, and for everyone who attended and the questions that we got. We really appreciate you being here. Just a reminder, if you we actually do have another quarterly investment outlook webinar on April 19th. The Boston Private Investment Team will be sharing their insights on the macroeconomic and market outlook for 18. Thank you again for everyone for the participation and the questions. We look forward to hearing from you if you have any questions from this. And if we didn't get to your question, we'll get to it through email. Take care, everyone.